jump in the night. Your heart fills with dread. Probably a murderer who wants you dead. It could be a ghost, a demon, or worse. Perhaps you're the victim of a witch's curse. It's hopeless, you're doomed. You'd call a priest if you could. You'd rather just listen to who? Sinister Who?
Since December of 2024, the killing of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson and the prosecution of the man accused of pulling the trigger, Luigi Mangione, has played out in the media and in multiple courtrooms. Our guest today has covered the case from the beginning. Brian Buckmeyer is a defense attorney and ABC News legal analyst. He's also the host of ABC's new podcast series, Burden of Proof, Luigi Mangione. It's the second season of a show that already covered the trial of Sean Diddy Combs in its first season. Now, with Mangione, Brian has been in courtrooms, read the filings, and talked to people closest to the case. And weeks ago, just after the podcast dropped, Mangione stood up and pleaded guilty to federal charges, setting off what may be a very consequential double jeopardy fight in an already high-profile case. Can't wait to discuss it all. Please welcome Brian Buckmeyer.
Thanks for having me. What an introduction.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being here. Well, first of all, congratulations on the second season of an already excellent podcast. You built this season as a five-part series, but the case itself has been moving as you're covering it. As we said, we covered this week, we do true crime headlines on the show, and we discussed the federal plea, and that happened right in the middle of your rollout. So what was that like, and kind of what does it do to a narrative podcast if the story is morphing right as you're getting your arms around it?
A lot of retracks. Yeah. A very patient EP and producers and team and very talented individuals who can put together a podcast that we anticipate will be complete, that we anticipate will give you all the information leading up to a very specific week as you watch this trial. And then all of a sudden, hey, there's a plea. We got to figure this out. Hey, there's a sentencing coming out. Hey, they filed a motion in state court. How do we make this as current and as knowledgeable for our listeners as possible? So it's a team effort, but all I've got to do is sit there and read. So it's not really my hard work. I would say it's everyone else's.
That's true. And I think for a legal analyst like yourself, it's good to have you at the helm because there is so much to discuss as far as the nuances and the tiny minutia, I think, that most lay persons that might be watching the proceedings might not catch. So when you listened to his plea allocution in court, I'm sure, you know, you listen with that legal lens. When he said, I knew what I was doing was illegal, you know, specific language that you heard him say, what did you hear in that strategically that perhaps a non-attorney might have missed?
I mean, I can tell you what I heard, and also I can tell you what I was doing, that while we are listening, and we have an amazing team, both lawyers and producers, so I'm listening to this plea agreement, knowing that the state case is still going on, and I was texting, I was saying, guys, the SDNY and the Manhattan District Attorney's Office is maybe 500 yards apart from each other. We should have someone in the state court because something's going to get filed. This is part of a larger strategy of trying to attack these two cases. Let's get ahead of this. And ABC was really good at it in the sense of, I think while we were still on talking about the plea and what was going on the allocution, and then the motion fell, we were already ready, had the motion, and talking about how it was interconnected altogether.
Yeah, it's that strategy that you had of like, get somebody at the state court. There's no way this does not impact that. And since we're already on the subject, let's talk about double jeopardy. I think a lot of folks assume that it just means what it sounds like it means, and it does not quite mean that. So would you mind walking us through why the Constitution generally allows the same act to be prosecuted by both the state and the federal government, and then this interesting wrinkle in New York law that might be double jeopardy plus, perhaps?
Yeah, so I think even as you like, kind of introduce it through that question, like use the word that's very specific that I want people to hone in on. You said being charged for different acts, or so the same act, sorry. Mm-hmm. Well, double jeopardy protects you from being charged by the same crime. And so that's the thing that I always tell people is a very different thing. We lawyers like to be very nitpicky with our words. And so you can, in fact, be charged for the same act. You could cross state lines, have drugs on you. That's a federal crime. You could kill someone as you do that. But possessing the drugs themselves and having a gun, for example, could be a state crime. And so just to kind of go from the beginning, everyone has a constitutional right of double jeopardy, not to be charged for the same crime. And so the way that it works in the law is we treat different states and sometimes the federal and state government as different jurisdictions or different sovereignties, like sovereignties in the way we talk about like different countries, right? Mm-hmm. And so when the feds have a crime that is very similar but not the same as the state, and under specific and unique situations, the feds and the state can charge you. Because in the eyes of the feds, for Luigi Mangione, at least now as he took the plea, he pled guilty to stalking resulting in death. Mm-hmm. But the state case would say, we're not charging him with stalking. We're charging him with murder in the second degree. There are different elements and different actions within those two different crimes. We are different jurisdictions, and therefore it is not double jeopardy. And that's how the idea goes. But to your point, New York, and probably because the Southern District of New York is in Manhattan, the Eastern District of New York is in Brooklyn, we are very close to New Jersey, we're very close to Pennsylvania, we sometimes get some crimes that are international in nature. New York's like, hey, we've got a lot of people coming in and out of here that we both have state and federal cases, so we want to increase the protections that we give to New Yorkers or people in New York when it comes to double jeopardy. And they have additional language. I'm not going to give it to you all.
Yeah.
But I think the one to hone in on here is, do the different jurisdictions have an interest in protecting a unique type of crime? And therefore, if the answer is yes, then it's not double jeopardy. And the reason why I bring that up is because I think at the heart of the case, this is what the defense is trying to argue, that stalking resulting in death and murder in the second degree are so similar that they should not be charged separately. That's double jeopardy.
Yeah, and that's what Mangione's attorney has said. You know, it's a weapon being used against my client, which inverts the way we normally think about double jeopardy should be a protection. You know, instead, do you think that her framing is persuasive? You know, I don't, from what I've researched, there's not a ton of New York appellate case law on this. But what you're saying for our listeners, you know, there's elements of a crime, the physical elements, the actus reus, and then the mental elements, the mens rea. And perhaps what the prosecutor's argument is in at the state level is the actus reus is in fact different, even though that they both involve death. Stalking is not the same as the elements of murder, and the mens rea is different. Like you intended to stalk and then it ended up in death versus you intended to kill someone. But there is still some of the overlap, and I think it's in the New York statute, just one little line, you know, kind of the, or it's trying to protect against similar harms or something. Do you think that his attorneys might have success with this argument? It's novel and you kind of have to try as an attorney, right? But I don't know, is it more of a stretch?
As a legal nerd myself, I love the argument.
Yeah, me too.
It is novel. It is unique. As a defense attorney who practices both in the Southern District and Eastern District and still has state cases, I'm going to use it myself.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a long shot. It is a 90-yard field goal. It is bases loaded, like grand slam. Whatever sports metaphor you want to use, it is that.
Yeah.
And it is that, not only in the sense of it is a long shot of an argument, because I don't see one, a trial judge buying it, because a trial judge is not going to say, I'm going to go out on a limb here in my own discretion and dismiss this case, especially because the political influence and pressure around it, these don't happen in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. There are politics and people need to get reelected, and the prosecutors represent the state and the judge wants to make sure that there's justice. Like, there was all that playing in. And so you got to ask yourself, does this judge want to stick their neck out on this novel argument? 9 times out of 10, the answer is no. Mm-hmm. So you lose at the trial court. Maybe, and if you've, I'm assuming that your fans are watching all true crimes, maybe you get a Lindsay Clancy situation, mm-hmm. where like in the middle of the argument, when you lose, you say, can I just run next door to make an appeal at a higher court before you say, we're going to go forward with this trial because I've lost this double jeopardy argument. Maybe that happens again. Do I think they win at the appellate level? I think there are recent cases that make that difficult as well. Mm-hmm. We'll be talking about Luigi Mangione for many years because this appeal is going to have to eventually happen after a trial and go up the ranks. I think that's more likely. I don't think it's likely that this state trial doesn't happen, but I've been wrong before. I'll be wrong again. And I think it's a great argument. I think it's the best one they've got. It's just really threading the needle.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it, threading the needle. And I think the DA has made it very clear, we have put a lot of work into this. We put a lot of effort into this. We're seeking justice on behalf of the Thompson family. This is more than, like you said, the political sideshow that's kind of, it has become with people making memes and turning this into kind of a folk hero narrative where there is a victim at the core of it. There is a family that seeks justice. And there is something to delivering to a family a murder conviction versus stalking that resulted in death. It almost, you know, I won't say it felt like a technicality, but the plea that they did in federal court almost seemed intended to go down this pathway. Do you think it tells us something about the fact that they really don't have any other opportunities as a defense to say, not my client didn't do it, but it's like he did this specific act that he will agree to? You think it's more of a strategy and just a really tough hand they've been held?
Yeah, I think like most defense attorneys, you kind of dance with the facts that you were given, so to speak. I think the one that everyone was talking about was clearly jury nullification. How can you find a jury that will have a consensus of 12 people that would convict Luigi Mangione? Roll the dice on that. And I agree, like that might have been a good strategy, but that is by definition of rolling of the dice. Mm-hmm. And I think I can talk about that as a good strategy. You can talk about that as a good strategy of having a legal background. But when you actually have a client, rolling the dice isn't something that we like. I think taking a plea this way and making the argument, as much of a long shot as it is, I think it's an intelligent argument. And at least you get to go to your client and say, hey, here's a path to winning. We plea in federal court. The sentencing guidelines I think you have are anywhere from 24 to 30 and a half years in prison. But we think we can get you lower than the guidelines because of your background, like who you are. Don't forget when they brought up the extreme emotional disturbance defense and then they quickly took it back. That defense could be used at sentencing in federal court to try to lessen jail time. Mangione's already been in for a couple of years. So you're really thinking, if I can plea here, get rid of the state case, get the lowest federal sentence possible, you serve this time in federal court. When you met Mangione as a defense attorney, you were looking at life or the death penalty, depending on what jurisdiction you're looking at. Now, the way you've kind of finagled it, you could theoretically be looking at 8 to 12 years if you make the good argument that he should be below guidelines. And by any stretch of the imagination, that's a win if you could get it.
Yeah, I think we often are able to play Monday morning quarterback, but you're right. When you're in the room with the client and it is their future and it is the future between life in prison or this some other federal sentence, and we can take into consideration where you're going to be serving your sentences. It's my understanding most defendants would prefer no jail, but if you have to go to prison, federal prison versus state. And it made me think of the Alec Murdoch case, which we've covered in the past and is in fact in hearings right now, I believe, because he has both the federal charges and the financial fraud, and then his state case got thrown out. So from the perspective of the defense attorneys working this, I mean, do you think whatever we can get our client, when we can get it for him, that is the win, despite the fact that you have this DA's office who said, we intend on fighting this, we're not going to let go. Do you think that the DA's office will actually give up if they are told, hey, charging for murder is going to be double jeopardy? Or do you think they're going to try to find, I don't know what other charges might make the victim's family feel like they've gotten some justice, but do you think there's some opportunity for a superseding indictment, you know, different charges at the state level?
I think there's an opportunity for that, but I think superseding indictment, I would say no, because I would position it as this. We're at murder in the second degree with a state case because the defense did such a great job of whittling away at the top charges. Mm-hmm. And so do they have an opportunity to indict and get those charges back or similar charges to that level? No, because they were dismissed in a way that I don't believe they can come back. I don't think they can get higher than murder in the second degree for adding other charges just because, again, the nature of how they charge it first time and then the motions cause them to be dismissed. If there were other facts that they could have used to get other charges, they would have done it already. So that's why I'm kind of imagining I'm so firm that they won't. Mm-hmm. I think they would go further go forward with the murder in the second degree just because of the prison time that's associated with that. And also just the word, right? Mm-hmm. They want murder. Mm-hmm. Murder just holds not only the prison time that I think they want, but I also think the connotation. Because I always tell people, and probably more so in this case, will probably be the big thing that's talked about at sentencing, the reason why the criminal justice system punishes, or at least the reason why it says it does, we can get into a philosophical conversation later, is to deter the public from doing the crimes that this person has done, mm-hmm. and to stop this person from doing this crime again. And I think there is no bigger example of those two things in this case, where we as a society don't want people murdering CEOs who have indirect connections to their grievances that they have. We don't want that for CEOs. We don't want that for politicians. We don't want that for judges, lawyers, people at the coffee shop, police officers, firefighters. I mean, the list goes on and on. Doctors, mm-hmm. like, sorry if I missed you. No, we don't want that. So as a form of deterrence, I could see prosecutors and judges saying, I've got to give Mangione a lot of prison time. Mm-hmm. The other aspect of, we don't want him to do the crime again. We don't want him to feel emboldened by another wrongdoing in society and only give him 5 years. He gets out in like 3.5, 4, and he does it again. So I think that's in the mind of the prosecutor of saying, no. This is why I need the big sentence, why I need the big charge.
That makes sense. And I think you're right. There is something to that, the phrasing of it, the word of it, of we have caught this person who gunned someone down on our streets in broad daylight. You know, people are walking to their meetings in the morning and offices. Sinisterhood, we'll be right back. Since you're in New York, I wanted to ask, what is the temperature around this fight? I know this has become the kind of a specific legal battle, certainly, but as far as just the general sense of justice, does it feel like, listen, he's already pleaded to the killing, he's admitted it in federal court, we're wasting state resources to do this again? Or is it more of a, well, that was for the stalking part, this is separate, and we want to see actual justice be served?
It's funny, so I am not a New Yorker. I've only been here for over a decade. I did some college here, so like let's say 15 years. So I'm going to adopt New York for a second here. The great thing about New Yorkers is we've got so much stuff in our day-to-day that this isn't really like a big thing on the radar. But to answer your question, when I go and get a suit dry cleaned, or I go to a restaurant, or someone recognizes my voice and face, they'll bring up Mangione, and the conversations I get land on the spectrum of, he just pled guilty because this is strategic. We still know he's not guilty. It's just his lawyers doing this for him. To ignoring the plea and just saying justice for Mangione, go to trial and fight it. To just curiosity as to why would you do this? I don't really get much else on that spectrum for people who are positively talking about Mangione. Of course, the people who negatively talk about him are saying, put him under the prison. We want as many years of prison time we can get from the feds. You want him to go to state as well and get there and run it consecutive. But from the supporters that I hear about in New York and talk to me about it, knowing who I am, kind of ambivalent or just looking at it like, this is strategy. Like, it makes sense.
Yeah, I think it's hard in a case like this. And I want to ask you, you've now covered this case as well as the Combs trial, you know, the same podcast. Have you found it to be a different task narrating a case in this, you know, where Luigi Mangione has been held up for his ideological beliefs and there's been some semblance of public sympathy, although, like you said, others who believe he should be severely punished, versus the Diddy one? It's a lot of horrific abuse allegations, the footage, things like that. Do you think the audience listens differently? And do you find it a different way that you approach the case, or is it just, you know, trial facts, however it comes out?
I think it's different in the sense, and I always try to bring it back to the law, just because that's my wheelhouse. And that's where I feel comfortable. And I think that's why people listen to me. Like, if you want to listen to me about being Canadian or a father, I think I'm pretty knowledgeable there, but it's not why ABC asked me to put a suit on. So we try to keep it legal as much as possible. But I do think it's different because of the concept of us. I think in the Sean Combs case, the concept of us really applied to the perception that the federal government had this ability to use RICO in a very broad way. And I think the concept of us is like, do us as a society think the prosecutors should use this power in this way, and bringing in the potential of using rap lyrics, but then also the concept of Me Too. And I think the Sean Combs trial really changed the concept of us when the Cassie video came out. Mm-hmm. Like that changed the tenor of the entire case. And then it was very much about abuse and women's silence and things of that nature. And the us is still there, but the us in that is not about the broadness of the prosecutorial power. Is the us in either protecting women, believing women, men of power, and silencing that. The us becomes different there. For the Mangione, the us is, I think, is very clear there. It never changed. It stayed very stagnant of healthcare and us. Brian Thompson got completely lost in that story very early on. We tried our best, and I think we did a very good job in the podcast of dedicating an episode to him to explain who he was, his connection to United Healthcare Group, the silence in the silence in social media about who he is, and almost treating him like an icon where you can say, you know what, forget his life. His life didn't matter because he's connected to this. He's a cog in the system of killing people through insurance. We're like, no, Brian Thompson is an actual person and we should talk about him. So I think the us changed in the way that we discuss the cases.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it as well. And I think, yeah, the facts definitely in the Combs was like they kept coming and kept coming. And with Mangione, the facts have stayed fairly narrow and the legal issues and questions kind of keep coming. But to the point of Brian Thompson, his family has been present, you know, sat in the courtroom for the plea. And in a series like yours, the true crime genre, especially in a case like this where it is so focused on this folk hero narrative, how important was it for you to juxtapose the grieving family, his family, as well as him as a person amongst this? Otherwise, like you said, most coverage sort of zooms out and says, yes, there was a victim here, but the real issue is this larger gripe. And I think, you know, not an incorrect gripe with the insurance system, but more so that it's so large that Brian Thompson doesn't measurably change things. I mean, United Healthcare immediately, you know, replaced him. So how do you honor him and also, strategically juxtapose the family's process with what Mangione and his defense attorneys are going through?
So I think two things. One, I would give the credit solely to the producers at the podcast team in 2020. They're storytellers. Mm-hmm. Through and through. And you can't tell the story of Luigi Mangione without telling the story of Brian Thompson. And I think if you're going to see any excellence in the way that we talked about Brian Thompson and the sympathy, that comes from all of the producers and the people who worked on it. And I'm excluding myself from that just because they're such phenomenal storytellers. But I will include myself and bring myself back in to the other aspect of it is when we were talking about this, there is either a trial about to happen or now a sentencing about to happen. And you have to talk about the victim in the case, mm-hmm. and how they are treated in society, how they are treated in court, and how they were treated by the defendant in order to get the best understanding of what will this trial look like? What will picking a jury look like? What will sentencing look like? What will the judge consider in sentencing? What will the prosecution argue both federally and from the state when it comes to sentencing? And so you've got to talk about Brian Thompson. You've got to talk about him as a human being if you want to have a real conversation about legal implications. So I think, and that's why I love working with the team, because we can both be happy and we can both provide the audience both of those aspects.
No, I agree. And I think this is a case that, like you said earlier, we're going to keep talking about this and keep talking about this. Do you think, you know, I know you're going to keep covering this case through October, the filings that are going to come, the hearing in December, whatever comes after that. If Judge Caro were to ultimately dismiss the state charges, that means Mangione could, in theory, walk free in, let's say, 30 years on the high end rather than life in prison. Do you think he'll be remembered if he succeeds doing something like that? Would he be remembered as a killer who got elected? Lucky break on a technicality, or somebody who the system was for political pressure reasons, you know, the federal government jumped in to prosecute what was a murder theoretically right away. Do you think he'll be viewed as someone who maybe exposed technicalities of double jeopardy, or does it kind of all depend on whether let's hypothetically say he is successful in his dismissal? Do you think that would be what that would do to his legacy?
So understand that I'm a very hopeful person in general.
Me too.
But I am painfully realistic. And so I think how we think of Mangione is going to be closely tied to our feelings about health insurance in this country. Mm-hmm. Am I hopeful that he will be punished and then people will pivot and say, you know what, we got the bad guy who did a thing for reasons we may or may not be sympathetic to, Now let's focus on the health insurance companies, because no one should be driven to the point of believing that murder is the right reason to solve this problem. Maybe we can take reasonable steps in making this process better for all, more affordable for all. And if that happens, then I think Mangione will be juxtaposed next to change in the healthcare system. And so, yes, after 30 years, there might be some positive, like, vibes or association with him in some way, shape, or form. But I can also see, and I probably think more likely than not, we're not going to see those positive steps in health insurance. Things are going to continually get bad, and people are going to continually get frustrated at the process and also the results. And I think in that sense, his identity follows our feelings of health insurance, and we remain divided. Mm-hmm. We have people who think he was right, it's getting even worse. And we have people saying, we can't live in a world where your gripes with a system leads you to murdering someone who is tangentially, indirectly connected to the harm you're talking about. Like, I think it follows how we feel about health insurance going forward. And I don't know what it's going to be like in this country 10, 20, 30 years from now.
Well, let's hope it's all fixed. And we'll say, man, it was so bad that a person felt like this was their only answer. And thankfully, we don't live like that anymore. Well, I feel like when we zoom out and take his, you know, horrific act into consideration, I think, like you said, as a society, we don't want to live in a world where it is settled in the street like the Wild West. That's why we have legal precedent and the system, right, that we hope works for us. Mangione has been fairly open about answering letters from people who write to him. He seems like I don't know that he's super chatty, but it is my understanding he will respond if you write to him. Do you think that once all of these legal issues are settled, that he will come forward and maybe share almost, I always refer to Catch Me If You Can, the Leonardo DiCaprio movie with Frank Abagnale, but then it turns out that guy wasn't, he, I don't know, whatever. But where a criminal says, yes, I did this, but here to you, the FBI or law enforcement or mental health authorities, here's what the process I went through. This is the spiral I went down. And if you want to avoid other vigilantes or avoid other ideological killers, here might be a way to help. Do you think he would be willing to do that? Or was it, he said, this is why I did it. And, you know, I did what I did.
I think that if there's a benefit to him, he'll do that. Mm-hmm. I think, and I hope, in my kind of playing this 3D chess of how this all resolves, I think there's a world where that happens sooner rather than later. Maybe mm-hmm. even this year, maybe December when he gets sentenced. Because if the state case does get dismissed, he doesn't have the fear of his statements at sentencing being held over him and the state case if he loses there on the motion and has to do the trial. Mm-hmm. So if the state case is gone, he can full-throated give a whole explanation as to why he did this, why he believes. And I think it's possible because it ties into what was initially raised as the extreme emotional disturbance defense. If I was an attorney, I would say, hey, look, he had back pains. We said that at the sentencing. It drove him to this place. He couldn't find himself in a right place where he can separate right from wrong. Not to the point that we're going to excuse it, but we're just using it for mitigation. Now listen to him. Mm-hmm. Listen to him talk about his back. Listen to him talk about his frustration. Listen to him talk about his angers and why it drove him here. Okay, now give him 12 years instead of the 24 to 30. So in a world like that, I could see maybe him talking like that, but the state case has to go away for him to have that freedom to do so.
Yeah, there's that danger there that you're going to, like, and that's why his allocution, I think, was so specifically worded that he wasn't just up there freestyling. Well, briefly, if we may just pivot slightly away from Mangione, we mentioned Lindsey Clancy up top. Have you heard Kevin Reddington, her defense attorney, make mention of a potential argument of double jeopardy due to the Massachusetts law? There's like a burden shifting. I think when the defendant objects to a mistrial, there's a burden that shifts to the prosecution to show manifest necessity to justify ending the trial. Is that another Hail Mary, perhaps, by a defense attorney who's just trying to do something?
So I am less familiar with that just because I'm a practicing attorney in New York.
It's a different state.
I've read it. So I am sorry if I'm not going to go in like into the weeds with it as much.
Totally
but
fine.
I do think it is a Hail Mary in the sense of I understand where he's getting to that argument. I agree with him in many senses. And I think even hearing the interviews from some of the jurors might even bolster his argument. Because so far we've heard from three of the 12. Mm-hmm. I think there was a sit down with three of them and then one individual where they're all saying so far, the one holdout heard the information, articulated that there was reasonable doubt, which makes sense because in the state of Massachusetts, the prosecutor has the burden of proving that they were not lacking criminal responsibility. So if the reasonable doubt assessment applies to the lack of criminal responsibility, it makes sense that 11 people wanted to find her not guilty based on lack of criminal responsibility. And one person was a holdout because they were not applying the law as three people were describing it. Now, I'm still waiting for that one holdout to come and talk. Mm-hmm. If he talks and he says, no, I applied the standard. I didn't believe she lacked criminal responsibility. I thought she was guilty. I was doing what everyone else was doing. I just came to a different conclusion. No argument there. But if he says he'd follow the instructions, then stop following instructions. I think the defense attorney's argument for a mistrial makes sense, saying that the judge should have explored more, asked questions. You would have knocked the person out. Then you wouldn't have had a mistrial. You did this incorrectly. I think that's all great. But the law in which he's pointing to as to what the judge should do always starts with, to your discernment. Mm-hmm. You have the ability to decide whether or not you want to go deeper into this inquiry. And this Monday morning quarterbacking isn't necessarily the way to get that overturned. Mm-hmm. But I don't know all the Massachusetts case law. That's not my state. I just know, generally speaking, the way these laws work in most states, that's a 150-yard field goal. You mean that's not a separate field, but hey, Reddington, if you got the juice for that kick, go for it.
I mean, you might as well try. And I think the manifest injustice is kind of the language, I think, or it's like a manifest necessity, a high degree of necessity. And it has to do with giving the extra instructions, sending them back again. And so I think it might be a little bit more difficult of a burden in this case because they did send them back multiple times. In fact, maybe one extra time than they even really were supposed to, because I think they sent them back twice and then the third time did an instruction. So all that to say, I think when you're in a case like either Mangione or with Lindsey Clancy, where you have facts that seem to implicate your client in some way, you kind of have to try anything that you can try.
Yeah. And the thing now I'm glad you brought that up because now it's jogging my memory as well. There are jury instructions for every state. Massachusetts is amazing, like New York, in that those are online, and so anyone mm-hmm. can look them up. And there's a charge of when the jury cannot consent. And if you go to the bottom, there are footnotes that talk about pre-Tui Rodriguez instructions. Tui Rodriguez is the charge that you give. It's called a dynamite charge. Mm-hmm. When a jury says they cannot come to decision, you kind of read them an instruction, say, hey, come on, you can do it, keep trying, and you send them back. And then there are Tui Rodriguez instructions. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the footnotes, the judge actually follows the way it's supposed to be done. The first one was a pre-Tui Rodriguez instruction. It's like a soft kind of pat, you can do it, keep trying. And then they came back a second time and he's like, all right, I'm going to read you the instruction. This is like the, come on, soldier, keep on marching. Mm-hmm. And then the Tui Rodriguez instruction, the footnote says, if they come back a second time, you shall not give them the instructions again unless A, B, and C, and A, B, and C didn't happen. So mm-hmm. he really followed the instructions as the instructions are supposed to be given. Mm-hmm. So what's to appeal?
Yeah, and that's what it felt like in the moment. The judge kind of said, my hands are tied. But I think you're right as far as, thread the needle, try your best, both with Mangione's attorney and with Kevin Reddington here. If it's a possibility, even if it's, what is it on Dumb and Dumber? It's like a 2% chance. So you're saying there's a chance. There is a chance. You might as well. I think you're a negligent attorney, perhaps, if you don't try. If you're aware of it and don't try.
Hey, I throw everything against the wall and the kitchen sink, your kitchen sink, the prosecutor's kitchen sink. If the judge will give me theirs, I'll throw that against the wall too. You're fighting for someone's life. I don't care how. So long as I can make an argument that will not get me disbarred, thrown out of the courtroom, yelled at, if it advances the interest of my client in a positive way, where there's a chance of helping them, I got to do it.
Yeah, that is the oath that we swear when we're attorneys. So as far as the Mangione case, what do you see coming next? What are you going to be looking to cover next? What are you anticipating? Any big moments that you are definitely going to be in the courtroom for? What should we look out for as burden of proof continues? Are you going to do more episodes now that it's extending out?
If it was my decision, there would definitely be more episodes. I don't know the answer to that. This is not one of those. And I know, I'm like the rest of you. I watch shows of movie people and TV people being like, just tell me there's going to be another season. Tell me there's going to be another episode. I don't even know. But I will say this. ABC has really done a great job of trying to meet the listener where they're at, where if there is an audience, we will put a voice there. So I cannot imagine a world where ABC doesn't hear, and to answer your question, the prosecution's response, because that's the next big thing. You're going to see a lot of us talking heads slicing this 20 different ways. The prosecutor's right. The defense is right. Now we have two arguments to compare and contrast. This person knows the judge. That person's argued in this courtroom. We can speculate as to where the judge will fall with these two different arguments. That's the next big thing. And I would imagine that we at Burden of Proof, for the show that we have 5 days a week, 5:30 to 6 p.m., or 2020 True Crime Plus, where we have the podcast, mm-hmm. one of those places are going to talk about this. But then, of course, and I can imagine definitely having a follow-up, the big thing is the sentencing. How many years is he going to get?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what are going to be the factors that either add to and end up with something close to a life sentence, or, like you said, maybe other factors that reduce reduce the guidelines and get him below that. And we'll see something in the, like you said, 12-year range or something versus him getting out of prison, you know, retirement age or something like that.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. We for those of you listening, if you want the most thorough, legally sound Luigi Mangione coverage, you've got to check out Brian Buckmeyer. He's the host, like we said, Burden of Proof, Luigi Mangione. It's from ABC News in 2020. It's available now wherever you get your podcast. Brian, thank you so very much for your time. We would love to chat with you again, whether it's about Luigi Mangione or any legal. It sounds like we've covered a lot of the same things you've covered. When we search you, when we're searching the cases we're covering, we always see your face, and we're always happy when we do, because we know we get the right answers, or at least a really good opinion that is based in your experience that we so treasure. So thank you.
I try my best, and thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Next time. Yeah, see you then.